Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Lawsuits and Employee Benefits Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 26, 2012, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Vance v. Ball State University. This case involves Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, a federal anti-discrimination law, and revisits the circumstances under which an employer may be held liable for harassment by its supervisory employees. If the alleged harasser has the authority to direct and oversee the work of the plaintiff, but did not actually have the power to terminate her employment or discipline her formally, can the employer nevertheless be held vicariously liable for the alleged harasser's misdeeds? To discuss the case, we have Jason Schwartz, who is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Schwartz.
This is Jason Schwartz, and I'm going to speak about the Vance versus Ball State University. This is a fascinating case that follows on from the court's seminal decisions in the Ellerth and Farragher cases dealing with an employer's liability for harassment perpetrated by a supervisor under Title VII. And the question that Vance takes up is, who exactly is a supervisor for whose harassment the employer is essentially automatically liable under principles analogous to agency principles under Title VII? And against the claim, the employer would only really have the affirmative defense that the employee unreasonably failed to take advantage of an effective complaint procedure that was present. So the presumption, in other words, is if this person is a supervisor, there's default liability unless the employer can make out the affirmative defense. And so the question in Vance is, well, taking that rule from Farragher and Ellerth, who is a supervisor to whom these kind of rules would apply? And the Seventh Circuit below had taken the position that in order to be a supervisor for whose harassment the employer essentially has default liability, you would have to have actual concrete authority, more like a Fair Labor Standards Act test for an exempt executive, that you'd have to have concrete authority over tangible employment actions, the authority to hire, fire, promote, make employment changes in status. That test is in contrast to the more flexible kind of multifactored approach that the EEOC has taken and that other courts have taken. In this particular case, in Vance v. Ball State, it's fascinating because it's pretty clear that under a variety of approaches, the result would be the same. Here we had a catering employee at the university who was claiming harassment by essentially a fellow catering employee. The fellow worker had some level of lead, quote-unquote, responsibility with some ability perhaps to oversee tasks or to direct assignments, but not really a very substantial role in doing it. There were higher-ranking employees further up the food chain, if you will, who actually assigned the tasks to the various catering workers, including the plaintiff and this coworker, and who set the hours and the expectations of the job. So the Seventh Circuit found pretty clearly that, well, this fellow catering worker doesn't meet our test. This person does not have hire, fire, or other types of authority over tangible employment actions. When it reaches the court, Vance, the plaintiff, essentially is arguing for a much more flexible test that takes into account much lesser degrees of authority to affect the day-to-day employment and the assignment of tasks. And then apparently at oral argument conceding that even under that more flexible standard, the record here is not so great for the plaintiff, arguing that, well, we didn't get a thorough opportunity to develop the record evidence on this issue because we thought we were operating under the Seventh Circuit's more restrictive test, and so we didn't develop this additional evidence. That claim seems doubtful because additional evidence was presented in the summary judgment briefing about the degree of control that this purported supervisor had. Interestingly, you have the government participating in this case, and the SG's office, along with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, appeared on their brief, and they argue that the test is essentially the EEOC's test and whether this individual, among other things, can control the daily work activities of the person who's claiming to be harassed. And the Department of Justice and the EEOC agree that on these facts, that test is not met, that the coworker did not have that authority that significant degree of control over daily work activities to meet the test that's established by the EEOC. And then Ball State University, of course, also agrees with the government that the test is not met here, but they propose a different test. Instead of the EEOC's multifactored approach, they argue that only where the authority that's granted to the supposed supervisor, quote unquote, materially enables the harassment, so the harasser uses that authority to perpetrate the harassment, well, then they count as a supervisor for whose conduct the employer is essentially automatically liable unless they can make up the defense. The oral argument is fascinating because it tests each of these theories. I think the court is searching for logical bright lines that it can apply, but none are readily apparent. The court tests with some hypotheticals. Well, what if you had a lead coworker who was responsible for selecting the music that was going to be played in the workroom all day, or for setting the thermostat, or for any of a number of other things that really on a day-to-day basis could impact somebody's employment, make them less likely to complain about the harassment, and therefore facilitate the harassment? But is it really fair to say that this person is a supervisor and to impose an additional burden on the employer to escape liability for their conduct, as opposed to the coworker test? Remember, if it's a coworker, that doesn't mean they get to harass for free. It just means that the employer is only liable for this misconduct if the employer essentially was negligent, knew or should have known about what was going on, and didn't take effective steps. And again, the facts are illustrative because every time Vance complained, Ball State University did take effective steps. They investigated and they took remedial steps to address her concerns. So I think it is a nice example of a situation where if you were to adopt a really broad definition of supervisor to include coworkers with just sort of tangential or incidental authority, you really may be holding employers liable in a way that is not fair because they're being responsible. They're doing everything Farragher and Ellerth are designed to encourage, to prevent harassment, to institute training, to have effective complaint procedures. And nonetheless, they're still held liable because some small modicum of authority has been given to somebody who's not really a supervisor. In terms of where the court will go with this, I think this is going to be a really difficult exercise because it's very hard, as I said, to come up with a bright line rule. I think the multi-factor test that the EEOC and the government are proposing may be where the court lands. Although, interestingly, Justice Scalia kind of went back to agency principles and said, well, this is where what we derive from the statute. And if that's really what we think the statute means, well, then doesn't that mean anybody who's got any sort of authority, like to set the thermostat or control the music, is acting as agent of the employer? And if so, then don't we apply the harder supervisor test to those people? So I think the possibilities are all over the map. The other interesting issue here is that you have the government and, as I said, Ball State agreeing that whatever the test, it doesn't matter, this person wasn't a supervisor. And so it'll be interesting to see whether the court is willing to go so far as essentially to grant summary judgment in the employer's favor or whether it's going to be remanded for further development as the plaintiff would like to see. I think the latter is more likely, not because the record has much to be added to it, but because the court's probably going to be reluctant to wade that far into the facts, although they might. And some of the questions suggest that the plaintiff was getting close to conceding that the evidence that they would seek is already in the record. So anyway, stay tuned. I think this will be a fascinating follow-up to Farragher and Ellerth and an important development in this area of the law.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.